So now we're into part two, presenting, pitching, and raising your value. So again, as I said in the beginning, this ties in to the negotiation aspect, because what kind of leverage you're able to produce within a negotiation has a lot to do with how you're perceived, what your value is perceived as being going into a negotiation, whether it be actual resources or things that are like these are the physical things I can bring into it, or the very concrete things, or just the perception of who you are. You going in and asking for a certain amount of money is going to be different than John Williams going in and asking for a certain amount of money. So what are we talking about now? So what we're talking about now is having control of how you're perceived in social and business interactions, being able to influence how people see your value, and understanding how decisions are made. Does anyone off the bat just sort of have any, and what I'm asking for more than anything is sort of an emotional response to like what that means when we talk about pitching or presenting to someone. Like, let's say you're in, the classic really is you're hunting for new work by going out and networking. Anyone have any kind of visceral first reactions to what that's about for them?
Yeah. Like a couple of weeks ago in Montreal, I had this event that actually Jeff and I were selected from a pool of applicants.
Yeah.
It's called Composer Speed Date. Speed Date. The tables and they rotate.
Yeah.
See you. So it'll be a director or a producer.
Yeah.
And of course, at the beginning, it's really freaky because I don't really know your film yet at all. So how am I supposed to? You have your media center where you can play stuff for them.
Yeah.
They listen to your music, and it's very daunting because you just have absolutely no sense of how they're going to evaluate a piece of music that you wrote, which wasn't intended for them in the first place.
Yeah.
Anything near. Because you haven't met them yet. It's just blind dating, really.
Yeah.
So it's very scary, but at the same time, as this thing started to circulate, we got the sense that, I got the sense that, I got to ask them what their movie's about. Let's leave the listening to music till the very end. And finally, I can maybe propose something that might work. And I think out of 13 people, I might have made one maybe connection.
That's great. That's that. If you made a real connection, that's a pretty good odds. I'd
said I was able to follow up on
and then
create other music that was a proper pitch for their film.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was effective, and I don't know if anyone else has been part of something like that, but.
That's a really interesting example. Anybody else have any kind of emotional or like first instinctual reaction to that?
What was
positive
the question
negative? When you think about presenting, like let's say you're in a networking situation, you're going to go up to someone you don't know, shake their hand. How do you feel about that? What's your first instinct going into that?
Me?
Or anyone?
Yeah, actually, I tried not to talk about music at all. I was sort of pretty honest about what are they doing in terms of power. Are they making the movie? What do they like about movies? I'm thinking more about what they do versus what I do, because I find that people don't really like it so much when you're pitching yourself. They like it more when you're just having a conversation with kind of just with a buddy. So I went to a networking event last weekend, and I found that not talking about music, they were more comfortable talking with you for half an hour. Talk about Batman, Superman, talk about a bunch of other movies that were coming out. And that led into what do you do, why are you here, what do you do, as opposed to, hey, I'm a composer.
Yeah.
Great man.
Yeah.
Right? So.
Yeah.
As opposed to just taking a business card and walking around, hi, I do music. You hire me tomorrow.
I've seen people do that.
Yes. Oh, I know. I used to do that when I first, when I was a band, in the 1990s, man. I thought that's when they're written, what it was like about. It's you go up to people with a business, hi, I'm Adrian, I do music. And literally some woman just looked at me and?
I also like to bring general interest into it. So if you just, doesn't matter what they do, could be any job, could be any industry, doesn't even have to be pitching for a composing job. It's just you want to talk about them and ask them, oh, that's really interesting, so tell me more about your job. Oh, that's really cool, you've been there. Oh, I've actually been there too, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
You just start having a conversation
that
can absolutely have nothing to do with anything that you're even trying to go there for.
Great.
And then at the very end of it, you're like, okay, well, I really enjoyed it, so here, take my card. Or check out my stuff, or don't even have to say that, but just leave. As long as the connection was a positive one, it's probably going to work out for you. And the job aspect of it, as long as you have a quick elevator pitch for what you do, in 5 to 10 seconds max, and let the whole half-hour conversation be about all positive, good things.
Half-hour conversation? Wow.
Well, 3 minute, half-hour, whatever it ends up being, just kind of go at it with, like, ask what their interests are, or ask more about them.
Awesome. Yeah, those are great. That's actually really positive. I'm glad you guys are approaching it with those kind of attitudes and outlooks. So, yeah, like, real situations where you're going to be using this kind of thing, where you're presenting. Like, pitching is not... I'm not really talking about sending in a demo, because that's really a low form of making a connection or making a relationship, but it's really about those real relationships when you're talking to people. So it's film festivals, networking, initial meetings or phone calls with directors when you're trying to sort of get that first sense or trying to pitch them on you or pitch them on your music being used. Or even during the spotting session or later on in that relationship when you've built the relationship and what you're trying to do is present reasons why, you know, the concept for the music or the way that the narrative is music is being used in the narrative should flow from your expert opinion. So let's talk about value for a second. What is value? So one of the things, value, it's interesting you think about value in a very different way than I think perhaps many people think, and maybe you guys are already on this bed, but I would say value is an agreement. It's a social agreement, right? What is money? Money is a piece of paper that everyone has agreed is equal to this amount of, when I hand it to you, you give me something that I agree is an equivalent value to this piece of paper. If everyone disagrees or if everyone stops agreeing that money is worth anything, you've got a piece of paper in your hand or a piece of plastic these days, right? It's not a fixed thing. Value is arbitrary. Value is fluid, it's changeable, it's a perspective, right? The Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius is fond of, because he was a Stoic philosopher, so he loved to look at things and take away the euphemisms for what they were. So roasted meat was simply dead animal that was heated up. And vintage wine was simply old fermented grapes. That's the way he looked at things. So he took something that everyone else agreed was very valuable and he looked at it for just what it was. Value is determined emotionally. It's determined really quickly if it's something new that you're not aware of, and it's determined intuitively. It's very rarely that we go out and make a decision, especially in our day and age, where we look at value and go, well, let me think about what this actually is worth. I'm going to make a pros and cons list, and I do 6 hours of research. No, you just look at something and go, I want that. I like this new thing. Right? You look at a new Apple computer, and you go, I like this thing. It appeals to me visually. It appeals to me emotionally. And you imagine you get that dopamine rush of thinking about yourself getting this thing and working with it and what it's going to mean to you. So it's not about the high brain function, right? It's about a very emotional, intuitive thing. And finally, value can be changed. You can change how you are perceived, what your value is. You can change that by projecting something different than what it is that you're currently projecting. Or maybe you're not even aware of what you're projecting. You want to start projecting something. And you're actually changing the social dynamic by doing that. So there's a really interesting story about George Clooney. Does anyone know the Clooney story? So Clooney was having, when he first started out in Hollywood, he just had a really tough time getting any gigs, if you can imagine that. This is a new George Clooney, not landing any gigs. You go out for audition. I think it was a year, he said, he wasn't landing anything. And what happened with Clooney was that it all changed for him when he changed his perspective. So what he was thinking of is that, in the way that most actors do, is they go to a casting audition, and they are not a solution. They are just another part of that puzzle that the casting director is trying to solve, right? They're not coming as a true solution to something. They're just a cog in the wheel, right? He saw what the producers were trying to do, that they needed to find somebody who really solved a problem as opposed to just being an actor that got a role, right? So it's a very different way of thinking about it. So he looked at it from their perspective. What are they trying to do? And I think it's the same thing for us. You're not just trying to put music to the film. That's a simplistic way of looking at it. You're trying to solve a narrative puzzle. How do you get people to understand and to connect with a character? How do you get them to like put what happened in Act 1 and Act 3 together? Because then you heard that theme and it connected and it was in a different variation that made you feel this thing, right? And sometimes when you're trying to produce, they don't even know that that's what it is they're trying to get at. So he changed his whole perspective and his towards auditions and towards the producers. So when he went in, he was no longer someone that was groveling for a shot. He was something with something really special to offer them. And it wasn't just the acting. It was his knowledge of storytelling. It was, all of the different aspects of the industry that he understood as an actor that he then brought to the table. And he was projecting that. He wasn't just coming in like most actors do and go, thank you so much for this gig, or please give me an opportunity. He just put that all aside and said, I'm the guy. Like, not directly, he's not coming and going, I'm the guy. He's going, I'm showing you I'm the guy by projecting a completely different perspective on what it is, based on what he realized their problem actually was. So, how do we decide? So the human brain is,
very slowly.
So here's a little human brain. There are three parts to how the human brain developed. And this is not a science lesson. I'm not expecting you guys to like come away with a degree in neuroscience or anything, but this is a very quick way of understanding how this works. So the three parts of the brain, reptilian brain, the midbrain, and the outer brain, which is called the neocortex. The reptilian brain is the oldest brain. It's the, as the name suggests, it's the brain that was first developed as mammals and reptiles landed on the Earth. So its function is one very specific thing, the midbrain. The reptilian brain deals with primarily survival, right? It looks at what's dangerous. It's processing very primal kind of things. What's dangerous? How can I look at something and determine whether I want to mate with it, whether I want to eat it, or whether I need to run away from it? The midbrain deals with very basic emotions and deals with social context. What does it mean when we talk to each other? What is your face saying about your what is your face saying to me about your reaction to what I just told you? The neocortex deals with high brain function, deals with things like figuring out math problems and solving very complex things. So
composing music.
Well, yeah, I mean that's interesting. Yes, composing music would be, right? So when we present complex things, we do it from the neocortex out. When people take in information, they process it through these brain levels. Each brain level processes the part of that information that is subject to its domain, and then, if necessary, passes that bit of information up through those levels. So danger, curiosity, fear. What is it to me? What am I doing with that? If I don't have to, if I can make a determination about what's going on, I'm not going to pass it up to the upper levels. So if we're talking about presenting something to a potential client, you have to realize that what you're doing is you're building something from the high functioning brain, the neocortex, outwards, but it's going to pass through the reptile brain first. So you have to think about how you're building your presentation, whether that's an actual presentation, a demo, or whatever else, or if you're just speaking to someone on a one-on-one basis during a meeting, how do you present that information, right? So when you're talking about the reptilian brain, because this is the important one, because everything is passing through it first, the first thing it wants to do is determine those three things. If it's not new and exciting, it's going to ignore it. If it's dangerous or complicated, it's going to run. And if it's new, it's going to get summarized radically. Right? So those are the three ways that the reptile brain wants to take any information, store it up, and either deal with it in one of those three ways, and if necessary, if it feels like, well, this might be something worthwhile passing up, then it'll pass it up. So the new and exciting part is the part that we're really interested in. It's the basis of our ancient hunting instinct, right? So we like colorful things, we like things that move, and we desire what moves away from us. So when you think about it in a physical sense, that's prey, right? So the ancient brain is interested in those things. It's based on curiosity and novelty. It wants to seek out those things which move away from us. So pause on that for a second and think about how we normally go after things that we want, right? When you want a new gig, or when you want to talk to someone about something, or you want to present yourself as a good candidate for something, you are in pursuit. But the reptile brain really desires something which is moving away from it, right? What you might be presenting might be too complex. It might not be interesting or novel enough, and therefore you're going to have a tough time getting through. So most of the time we're not using facts and figures to make decisions. We're using emotion, gut feeling, instinct. So like when they're looking at neuroscientific experiments, they've shown that They can actually look at brain activity, and if they have a selection of buttons that people can press, and different outcomes will come based on those pressing those buttons, they can actually determine several seconds before the person's made the conscious decision of which button to press. They can already read that based on your brain information. So you're already making decisions on an emotional gut instinct level before your conscious mind is even aware of that. It's also something that Malcolm Gladwell refers to in his book Blink as thin slicing, where you're taking all of your unconscious brain is taking essentially a whole lot of unconscious and long stored and lots of experimental data from your entire life and applying that in an absolute microscopic amount of time to determine whether you like or dislike something. Is anybody lost yet as to how this makes sense for what we're talking about? So again, we chase what moves away from us, we want what we can't have, and we place value on things that are difficult to obtain. So you look at any new product line coming out of the tech sector, you can understand instantly where that applies. We want those things that move away from us, we want what we can't have, and we place value on things that are difficult to obtain. The problem is, with what we do, is that we are passionate, creative people who desire nothing more than to be working on our craft and to be working with others on our craft. So we actually act in a way that is counter to what our own brains would like to receive in those situations. We move towards things, we make ourselves available, and we usually diminish our own value. So we don't act on the way that the brain is actually looking to perceive things. Any questions on that so far?
So what's the solution?
Well, we're gonna get to that. So that's the first thing to understand is how the brain processes this information, because it's the basic neuroscientific reason why what we do often fails. So there's something that Oren Claff in his book Pitch Anything calls frames, and I think frames are basically like a status. They're the way that we rank people based on who they are, what their perception is, what they've done. You know, it can be a money thing, it can be power, it can be their, like if you're talking to someone who's, like if it's the old thing when you meet someone famous, you're just like, and you can't talk, and you're like, oh my God, you're so amazing, right? Like, why, this is just another human being. Why all of a sudden are you losing your mind in the presence of another human being? They don't wield any special power, they don't have any control over you like in the vampiric sense, it's because of their status. So, when we're looking at frames are value, they're power, and they're projected by people. When two frames collide, one frame subverts the other. It's impossible to have two frames existing in the same realm. So one of these frames might be you as a composer and what you're doing and all of the value that you present versus a high power producer, right? You're talking to someone who's wielding more power than you. They have something to offer you. They have a longstanding work in the field, and they've got a long list on IMDb, and they've done all sorts of shows, and you want what they have, right? That's an example of a power frame, where you're walking into the office of Chorus or CTV or something like this, right? And meeting with someone who, after many corridors and many reception desks, you finally get to meet this person in power. That's a different frame than yours. How that interaction goes determines the next set of things that happen in terms of your negotiation or in terms of how you're able to build value. Does that make sense? This is basically the day-to-day. Whenever you meet someone anywhere, it's that collision of frames. Who's going to, when you go into a Starbucks, you wield the power of the client. You have the money, you have the power to say, this is what I want in my drink, and it's, the barista just has to subvert you. They're not going to say, well, actually, I'm going to give you this other drink, and you're just going to drink it. They're not going to do that. So here are some examples of how to subvert this whole reptilian brain thing. If you're dealing with someone more powerful than you and you're trying to create a situation where that is subverted, what are some things you can do?
Say it again.
Let me put it in a context. Let's say you're going into Chorus and you've got a meeting time. You show up for your meeting. You get to the front desk. You check in with the receptionist. She makes you sign a piece of paper that says you're here. She says, I'm going to call up to the person. Okay, great. They'll be down in 10 minutes to get you to sit over there. And then the person comes down or tells you come up or they come down and get you, right? What's the power differential there when you're in that situation? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Well, you're on their turf.
You're on their turf.
And they've biased it in their advantage.
Yes.
So you're asking me what I can do instead?
Yeah.
I personally, I bring it, try to bring it into a personal level. A day event, the weather, anything to bring it down to a personal level.
Okay.
So
does that do
human to human?
Yeah. When you're talking about something like value or your status, does that help raise it or change? Does that change that dynamic at all?
Sometimes. Actually, in from my own experience, more often than not. So what you were referring to earlier, when you're networking,
mm-hmm.
trying to bring it to a personal level, forgetting that you're a composer, let's say,
yeah.
asking about them. So generally, that's what I try to do.
Yeah. That actually is a good point. It feeds back into the whole idea of negotiating, really telling a story that makes you a bigger part of their social dynamic, right? So as opposed to just seeing you as a composer who I need to get something out of, they see you as a person who they actually like, and now it's more difficult to change that, right? This is actually a really interesting story in Blink, if anyone's read that book, where they talked about
I think it was a way of explaining intuition in a sense.
Yeah, no.
Like
it was specifically with the doctors, right? So there, it was an insurance company who was trying to determine which doctors would get sued most often. So they looked at doctors' records. They go, who makes the most mistakes? Who's sort of writes the poorest charts and is sort of doing all this other stuff that sort of would suggest that they would be the ones that got sued more often. What it actually turned out was the people that got sued most consistently were the ones that spent less time with the patients. It made less of an effort to speak to them on their terms and explain things step by step. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, blah, 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 make a connection. Right? So what we're talking about here is slightly different. So what we're talking about is how to change the power structure of a certain thing, right? To not always be, because what we like as composers, as creative people, is to not rock the boat, and we don't, and this it's this idea of value, right? Like, where do you fit into the value chain? If you're seen as, and even that conversation, although I think that's an interesting way of approaching it, what you're doing is you're just going, oh, I'm nice guy Nick. I'm
trying to make a connection.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I'm just putting in the
different
context
of
what we're talking about here, right? Like there's these different frames, and you have something to gain, or you want to change the conversation a little bit.
Changing the
dynamic, exactly. Anybody else for how you might change that social dynamic?
Are you talking about at the initial meeting?
That's one example. There's other examples, right?
Well, I would go into a situation like that and go, okay, well, regardless of my relationship with them, if we ended up working,
mm-hmm.
and let's say it was a situation where they did take publishing, I'm bringing them money that they would otherwise not see. So I'm adding value to their project. I'm obviously creating a solution for whatever. I bring the emotional context to their frame or to their production. And on top of that, I'm also bringing in revenue, so I'm actually a stakeholder now in the entire project.
Mm-hmm.
So I see myself as on equal footing as almost anybody else who's a stakeholder in that process. And being and also knowing that I'm a creator. Because, you know, if you think about it, our lives are, I create something out of nothing, and I sell it. There aren't that too many people on the planet who walk this planet and make a living who do that.
Mm-hmm.
Two other options. Meet your turf, or
meet
in mutual.
Great.
That's neither yours nor theirs.
Right. So one way of looking at that is it's called a small denial, or an act of defiance. So what you're doing is instead of just giving into something, you're creating a slightly tense situation for just a moment that you're going to release almost immediately, right? So instead of going, I just accept your frame, I accept your power, I'm just going to go along with whatever it is, I'm going to sit there nicely at the front desk and I'm going to accept all these things that are happening, I'm going to change this dynamic slightly. So one of the ways is, you know what, I think I'd rather meet at this coffee. I've got this great coffee shop, so let's meet there. It's going to be great. It's got the best espresso, you know, blah, 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 whatever.
On
so on you, right?
No,
so
no,
you
can
take
tell
it.
Them you'll pay, so...
You'll pay?
Yeah.
Who's going to pay?
Me.
They. When I say you'll pay, you're going to buy me this great espresso.
Yeah.
No, I know what you're saying. What I'm saying is one step further, right? That's an act of, a small act of defiance. Now, the thing to keep in mind with any of these things when you're doing this is you have to do it with a sense of humor. It has to be very light. And what you're trying to upset the status quo. You're trying to say, you know what? This is a game we're both playing. Because when you're talking to producers especially, this is what they live for. They live for this kind of stuff. They want to play a game. They will respect playing with a partner, like in a chess game. If you come in, you got no opening moves and you got nothing to offer. The person who's good at playing chess is going to be, well, whatever, yeah, you just get off the board. You know, I'm going to play something else. If you can show, A, you understand the game, and B, you know how to play it, and you're interested in engaging with it, that's going to actually increase your value, and it's going to make you seem more credible. Small acts of denial or small denials are acts of defiance. So one of my favorite small denials is when people ask me for versions. Like, let's say someone says, well, I'm really interested in working with you. I'd like you to come up with, like, you know, six different versions of the theme. I'll go, I'll give you one. I'll give you the right one. Because for me to spend a bunch of time on stuff that I know doesn't work just to give you options doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't provide any value, right? So, you know, and that may not work. I mean, I'm saying that you do this and they go, okay. They're going to go, what? But they're going to go, what? That's the main thing. You're just going to say, sorry, hold on a second. You change your conversation sense. Therefore,
no, I was going to say, give them six of the same and they'll hear
you. That's tricky, right?
It's happened.
That happens.
Been very happy.
Yeah.
Because they pick version 4 and it's like, this is way better than 1. Okay.
Right. I like that. I think that some people play that game too, or you get some, like, well, I don't like the oboe, and there's no oboe in the track. So you go, yeah, I took out the oboe, and they go, great, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
And you just sent them back to the same track, right? But slightly different.
You have to rename it.
You have to rename it. Yeah, you don't want to be caught with the same exact thing. So does that make sense? Do everyone sort of understand what acts of small denial are? They can be very subtle, like saying, well, let's change the meeting spot, or they can be more overt, like, no, I'm not going to give you this, or no, I won't play this particular game that you're playing. You can be very creative with this. And you can. The point is to have some fun with it.